tape going?
My name is Dan Austin. I'm at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Ralph Houck in near Dundee, Florida. The date. This is Dan Austin. The date is Thursday, October the 26th, 1990. I'm at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Ralph Houck in near Dundee, Florida, in the Cypress Wood Country Club area. And Mr. Houck has granted that we do this for the Baseball Hall of Fame, recalling some of his memories of growing up in Lawrence, Kansas, and developing an interest in baseball, and then that rich history of many years in the major leagues, both on the field as a field manager and later in the front office of a number of teams. Mr. Houck, thank you, and would you begin by your birth and growing up in Lawrence, Kansas?
Well, Dan, as you know, I was born outside of Lawrence on a farm and was raised there. I got really into baseball due to the fact that at about the age of 11, I guess, they had what they call a little league in Lawrence, and my uncle, Charlie, his son played in there, and they took me in, and that's how it all started. So.
Started out as a catcher?
Started out as a left fielder, but then I became a catcher about a year later when I was about 12 years old. So that went on into the Van Johnson League, which was, you could be up to 21 years of age. And at the time I was playing all the sports at the Lawrence High School there. I think the coach's name at that time was Woods. And upon graduation from high school, I had a chance to play football at Oklahoma or basketball at Kansas University under Fog Allen. Mm-hmm. Well, it so happened in the our Lawrence Van Johnson team was a pretty good team, and we got into the national tournament, which was held in Concordia, Kansas, and then the finals were in Kansas City. And a scout by the name of Bill Essex was there, and more or less must have thought I had some kind of ability or something, and he asked to see my parents, and finally offered a contract of $500, which in those days sounded like I was a millionaire.
Now, what year was this?
This would have been 1939, I guess. 39. Or 38, it would have been the summer.
In the Depression.
Yeah. And we discussed it, and they said, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. So in 1939 would have been my first year in pro ball, and I eventually was sent to Neosho, Missouri, and that started my career.
Okay, about a class...
That was a Class D. That's as low as you could go.
Was that what they called the Pony League or something?
No, it was Arkansas-Missouri League. And,
okay.
And we had, believe it or not, only four teams was in that league. I think it was Carthage and Neosho, where I played, Fayetteville, and Monette. And we had more fights, I think, than we had more ball games.
Well, you were down there in the country of the Boyer brothers.
Yeah, and Sherm Lawler played for Fayetteville that year. And then later there was Jerry Lumpy came up from Springfield.
Oh, he came out
that
of there,
was
too.
Quite a few years later. But it was a lot different in those days.
The fields were certainly different.
We didn't even have a shower at the ballpark. We dressed in a boarding house, and of course we had to pay our own expenses there. And she would serve breakfast and then an afternoon meal. And if I recall right, we paid something like $6 a week per room and board for them two meals. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the highest paid players on the team. I was making $75 a month. So from there on, that's where my career in baseball more or less started. Mm-hmm. The next year I went to Joplin, and following year I went to Binghamton to start with, and then was sent to Augusta, Georgia. From there the war started and I went into the Army.
And you were in the Army there for, 4 years?
Yes, then? I was in the Army 4 years. I went in 42 and came out at the end of 45.
Okay, and then that's where you achieved the rank of major, and that's your
nickname?
Well,
yeah, actually, I became a major on when I was let out.
Mm-hmm.
The highest rank I really held during when I was active in the war was I was a captain for a short time.
Mm-hmm. And you served in the European Theater of War?
Yeah, we landed at Omaha Beach, not on the D-Day, but mm-hmm. sometime later. And then, of course, went on clear through the war, through the Battle of the Bulge, and on into Germany and so forth, across the Rhine River.
I think Steve Suchok was in the Battle of the Bulge, if I remember
correctly.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, I think, I forget who he was with. I was with the 89th Recon at that time,
uh-huh.
and we were attached to both the 3rd and 1st mm-hmm. Army most of the time.
Okay. When you came out of the war, it was, the 45 season really was over, so you were getting, you went back into baseball immediately?
Yeah, I was on the AAA contract, or on their roster of Kansas City, so I went to spring training with the Kansas City Blues, and then from there was sent to Beaumont, the mm-hmm. Texas League, in 46, and at that time Jim Turner was the manager at Beaumont, and I had a fairly good year there, and Turner taught me an awful lot about baseball, especially about pitching, and I've always admired the man, and as you know, later in my career I managed to get him back as a pitching coach. In my opinion, he was the best one I ever had.
So he taught you a lot about managing, as a catcher, how to manage the pitchers during a game?
He knew so much about pitching and how to train pitchers, and that's what I followed mostly.
Can you give a couple of tips of what he actually did in so the guys wouldn't tear up their arms or throw?
Yeah, he believed in pitcher getting a certain amount of rest, and he guarded them like they were little children. I mean, he knew exactly how many minutes they threw, and when we'd go to spring training, he'd elevate how much they threw each time they were out mm-hmm. there. And he had a progressive way of training them. In other words, he didn't rush them into anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he had great ideas on pitching, and they were his boys, and he protected them, boy, and he made them, they didn't throw without him knowing it, and I followed his system of training pitchers, and it worked out very well for me.
So in your own major league managing career, you really based a lot of what you learned from Jim Turner.
I did, especially in handling pitching, mainly, and I started my own way of keeping records, which I think they all do now with computers and everything, but
mm-hmm.
I knew exactly each day, even when I managed in AAA in Denver, how many minutes that fellow had pitched or warmed up, and
mm-hmm.
I fought and to the glove and batting practice and mm-hmm. games, and it served me well, and I think most managers have that type of system now, but a lot of it's done on computers.
Yeah, everybody talks about Tony La Russa and his computers, and Earl Weaver, and he'd keep records of how well that pitcher would do against certain batters.
We all have that.
And
I think all managers have that. There's one thing though that, in my opinion, that a computer don't do, and that don't tell you what kind of a heart the man's got.
That's right.
And
that's the attitude inside.
That's right. And so.
You in the major leagues after the war, you served under two really distinctive kinds of managers, Joe McCarthy and Casey Stengel.
Well, actually, I missed Joe. I knew him.
Oh,
But I my first year in 47, Bucky Harris. Bucky was the manager,
uh-huh.
and you're right. He was an entirely different person than Casey.
Mm-hmm.
Bucky, I love Bucky, but Bucky wasn't.
Was he just easygoing?
Not as easy as some people might think, but he had a way of making you like him.
Uh-huh.
And but he didn't tell you an awful lot. Like if you didn't play, he didn't tell you why you weren't playing.
Hmm.
But other than that, he was like a father to you. He protected mm-hmm. you, and he didn't criticize you to the press, and I learned that from him. I think there's too much criticism of players today to the press by some managers,
mm-hmm.
and I think that takes away the some of the good of the player. I think a lot of players forget that most of the ball players are young, and really just kids.
Yeah, they're kids.
They're kids, and they have young parents. Some of them have young families.
Mm-hmm.
And when they read in the paper bad things about their husband, that worries them. Mm-hmm. And then when it gets back to the husband, then all of a sudden I think it's on the player's mind. So I think if you can protect your players the best you can from the bad things that might come out in papers, mm-hmm. you're better off. Now, Casey was all baseball. That's all there was.
Yeah,
there was nothing
life.
Else. It was just baseball. And in his way, he got a lot of things done that people didn't realize. A lot of that talk they talk about, in mm-hmm. my opinion, Casey had it pretty well planned. and so he knew what was going on. Like, mm-hmm. and if he made mistakes...
Dumb like a fox, huh?
That's right. He taught me one thing. He said, never second-guess yourself to the press. He says, always have a reason for what you did, whether you know it was wrong or right.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, Casey, how could you do a thing like that? He said, well, he said, think about it. He says, the press don't know about as much as you do about it. And you can always come up with some reason you did it, which is true. Mm-hmm. There's always a reason
sure.
why
yes.
you did something.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And even if you wish you wouldn't have done it that way, have a reason why you did it. And they can't really, they can say what they want to, yeah. but a lot of them, they won't know what the answer yeah. is. Like, he was a funny guy. And I liked Casey a lot. There'll never be another Casey, I don't think. I know we were still traveling on trains then. And my favorite story, which I've told before about Casey, was when I first came up to the Yankees as a coach that first year in 58, we was traveling by train. I don't remember what towns it was, but we always had our own private diner.
Mm-hmm.
And the coaches always ate with Casey. And the youngest coach always had to stay with him till he was ready to leave, well, or more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey, you know, after ball games, he'd have a little joy juice once in a mm-hmm. while, and they all like to eat and mm-hmm. get out of there. So now I join, and he said, okay, Ralph, you're the man, you got to stay with it. So we're traveling, and after we'd ate, and he said, well, now, he says, let's talk a little. And he says, what do you think of the hit-and-run play? And I said, well, Case, I think it's, you know, depending on the pitcher that's pitching and mm-hmm. who you have hitting mm-hmm. and so forth. I said, I think it's a pretty good play. He practically interrupted and said, he says, worst play in baseball. He says, terrible. He says, just an awful play. And went on and on. He must have talked 30 minutes just telling me why it wasn't any good. It couldn't have been 2 weeks later, and we're on a train, same kind of a situation. And he forgot, I guess he asked me. And he says, Ralph, he says, what do you think of the hit-and-run play? And I said, Case, you know, I really don't like it too well. And he says, it's the best play in baseball. And he went for 30 minutes.
He went 30 minutes
what
on the
great
inside
play
it
was. He just wanted to talk baseball. Uh-huh. And he could come up with some real peculiar things at times. But he knew what he's doing.
Uh-huh. So, anyways, you through Jim Turner then, and then with... Bucky Harris and Casey Stengel, that you learn a lot of the coaching and managing of how to deal with the players, many of them young, what to say to the press and what not to say to them. Surely yeah. you picked it up, though.
I think you must have had
instinctively some other things because of the many years you've been a manager, that you had some ideas yourself as you came up to the big leagues about being a manager.
Well, I think anybody knows baseball that's been in baseball. I mean, I think people that think about why this guy didn't hit and run or why mm-hmm. this manager didn't bunt, that's, or maybe use a hit and run or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
All players know how to do that, or managers mm-hmm. know all those things. I think managing is strictly handling your pitching staff, mainly,
mm-hmm.
and not overworking them. Get the best out of them you mm-hmm. can. Like Weaver said, know which ones pitch against this club, how much mm-hmm. days their man has to have a rest in the bullpen. And keeping the players where they'll give you the most of their ability every mm-hmm. time they're out there. Mm-hmm. Of course, you play a heavy schedule. But it's controlling the players and the press and getting the most out of each individual player. I think that's the whole answer in managing myself.
You say what a computer can't do is measure attitude and heart and
right.
how much that player is going to dig out for first base.
Right. It doesn't tell you which one you have to pat on the back or handle in a different way, or the one.
But
you must
have some
kick.
Kind of intuitive feeling to get that. I mean,
I think being in the Army, being under the pressure of seeing people killed and hurt, away from their families and home, I think that might have helped my career a little bit. I think I learned to understand pressures of the men. And I always felt the manager that could handle the players that weren't the stars and never played that much, the bench in other words, or the in-between players, was more important than handling the stars. Because they're going to play every day, or most of the time if they're healthy.
Yes.
And yet that poor fella sitting in the bullpen that didn't, of course I spent most of my time in the bullpen.
You had your back to home plate.
Well, about the only thing I did was break in Yogi's glove. So that's where I spent most of my career. So I think that might have helped me understand the problems of the lesser pitcher, the bullpen pitcher, or the middle line pitcher.
You could see the pressure that they
that's
were going
right.
to be facing
and
how they
and
were.
And I talked to them an awful lot and tried to let them know how important they were to the ball club.
Steve Suchok, when I first met him, he gave you an ultimate compliment. He said, there are very few managers since the end of the reserve clause, you know, with the Curt Flood case back in the early 70s. There are very few managers who knew how to handle young ball players. He said, Ralph Houck knows how to do it. And he mentioned a couple of others, and I thought of that as indeed an ultimate compliment. I think it's coming through in what you've just said now, that how to handle those young people. Maybe it came from the war experiences. Maybe it came from the farm in Lawrence or with Jim Turner to boost, give them that positive reinforcement.
Well, I think, you know, maybe due to the fact that I didn't get to catch that much when I was an active player with the Yankees, maybe that made me realize, like I had mentioned, one of the managers I had wouldn't let you know why you weren't playing, and you thought you'd been doing real well. Fact is, I was benched after we had won 8 out of 9 games that I caught, and I just couldn't believe that they would. But all of a sudden, it was never mentioned why. And in those days, you didn't discuss much with the manager. He was the boss. Today, I think managers are closer to their players than they used to be. And even like general managers. Well, when Mr. Weiss was general manager, if we seen him coming down the street, we'd cross on the other side of the street. You know, now they come in and chat and run right in the clubhouse. But no, you didn't do that in those days. No way.
There was really a line of demarcation.
There was a line
right
of demarcation, is right.
Of course, most people think of your career with the Yankees on the field and in the front office, and I like to come back to that, but I must bring up that here, when you went with the Minnesota Twins, I believe in the fall of 86, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I was with them in 87 then.
And then, in 87, a championship team, almost a turnaround from what they had been in the early years. And I'm going to say, without knowing anything, that a lot of it was due with some what you did. And, you know, that just doesn't happen to a team that can turn around in 1 year. So would you brag about yourself, what you did?
No, I'm going to have to demote myself.
Okay.
Now, I was made vice president of baseball there. They had been after me to come up there with them. And so I did join the organization. That was due to Andy McPhail's daddy. As you know, I'm very close to Lee McPhail. The fact is, he had a lot to do, I'm sure, with me managing my first years in Denver. So they wanted me there and said, look, you know, we got a young organization. They had changed the organization. And so when they kept after me, and I decided to do that, but I would give all the credit to Andy and to Bob Gebhardt. And I might have had some impact somewhere along the way in saying, I think this would be a good move to make, or this and that. But they did all the work. I was a sort of in the background.
Maybe as a consultant.
That's right. And then after that year, I did become a consultant, and because I didn't want to go up there that often. But I enjoyed it, and I was, well, I got their ring.
I see that. That's their ring. I was admiring that one.
And this is the ring that we got for our five, the ones that were on the five world championship teams in a row of the Yankees. We all got the fives on ours. I don't know how many there were, maybe 10. So I'm proud of that ring.
Yes, indeed.
But
Well, that was a scrapping team of the Minnesota. You know, they were down, a good ball club,
and they still are. They didn't do well this year, but their pitching went bad on them, and they couldn't control. Of course, the free agent draft now makes it impossible to keep some of your best players if they want to go somewhere else. And to me, that's hurt baseball. But
the pendulum has swung from one extreme to the other now.
That's right. And most ball players, you can't blame the player. It's the agents that have got into it and the owners that have went ahead and paid that kind of money. But you can't blame a player for wanting to go to play in California, probably, or someplace like that. And with the big salaries, it's just the way it is.
Yeah. TV royalties.
Absolutely. Minnesota, Kansas City, clubs like that can't compete with New York or Los Angeles. There's no way.
Going back to the Yankees, as I shared with you before we started, that it'd be through reincarnation that I'm going to wear pinstripes at first base, Mr. Houck. if I may interject, my baseball hero was Lou Gehrig.
He's a great man.
I was just a kid. I was born in 1936, so it was really by stories that I heard about him. And of course, I've seen the film and Gary Cooper and the like. So I say that only as an afterthought because incredible slugging average and RBIs and a lot up there with Hack Wilson, if I remember correctly. Be that as it may, were you there when they had Babe Ruth Day in 1948?
No.
Mr. Houck?
No, but I met Babe Ruth.
Did you? Could you share a story, if you don't mind?
Today, when I met Babe Ruth, we were playing an exhibition game. It would have had to have been 1947, I guess. What year did he die?
48, June of 48.
Okay, it would have been 47. And we were playing in the old ballpark over in West Palm, as I remember, an exhibition game in spring training, and here come Babe Ruth. And he's just like he was pictured in so many, I was in awe. He had the coat on, the brown tan coat with a hat, and I never even got his autograph. But now, because I never have kept much of that stuff, and there it was. So that's when I met him. And he must have been something else again. You've heard so many different stories.
Oh, yes, all of us who are baseball fans.
No question.
The personality.
It must have been something out of this world. Yeah. I know.
You served on the only team in professional baseball to win 5 straight World Series. As you said, I think there were about 10 of them from 49 to 53.
Right.
Probably never to occur again.
I would doubt it.
Dynasties are really gone in baseball and other professional sports. Could you describe a feeling that you think captures the makeup of that team? Because the 1949 team was really not made of a lot of superstars.
Well,
DiMaggio was injured, and really Casey Stengel used the platoon system to use the best of the players.
Well, in all the Yankee teams that I was on, and that carried right on and on after that through 61, and I inherited a very good ball club in 61. But the Yankee ball clubs in those days never thought about hitting averages or how many home runs they were going to get. And when they went on the field, they thought they were going to win that day and had to win, and they more or less policed themselves. I mean, if you didn't try to move the runner from second to third with nobody out, boy, you were in trouble. Or if you didn't run a ball out, or if you didn't go from first to third when you should. In other words, all the little things that win ball games, if you didn't do it, somebody was liable to get on you because they said, hey, you're messing with my money. And then we didn't make that much money. And so you played that way.
And played hungry.
You played hungry. And they thought they were good, and they went out and did the things that you were taught to do. You were taught baseball mostly in those days in the minor leagues.
That's right.
You had a lot more experience, you were expected to know and do those things when you joined the Yankees. And of course, there were a few that didn't have that much experience, like Bobby Brown, for instance, didn't have a lot of experience. But for the most part, they had 5 and 6 and even 7 and 8 years experience in the minor leagues, so you were expected to do that. And that's the way they played ball.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to execute the little things in baseball.
When you said that, I know that today the sports writers talk about, oh, this is the first guy that hit 30 home runs and steal 30 bases. And I asked myself, well, why steal base number 30 if it didn't make any difference in what happened in the game?
That's right. Well, take a player like Mickey Mantle. He's the best player I ever managed. I mean, at the age. I had Kaline and Yastrzemski and all those guys, but they were toward the end of theirs. But if Mickey, if we'd have let him, Mickey could have hit 40 home runs and stole 40 bases every year he played, but we protected him. Fact is, in, I don't know whether it was 61 or 62, I had a sign with Mickey, not a regular sign. He would, if he was on first base, he'd just look the dugout. And if I went like this, that meant he could steal. If I went like, no, he can't steal. And he used to get mad when I would let him steal, because the pitchers would walk him maybe intentionally or practically intentionally, and that'd get him perturbed that he'd want to run. I have no known, because I was afraid he'd get hurt. And I think that year that he was only thrown out one time, stealing second. And every time that the steal was, it was either the tying or winning run.
Yes.
And that's an
it
amazing.
It was done in that sense.
Yeah.
On that kind of maneuvering, I heard Red Shandies, who's been with the Cardinal organization
forever,
with Bill Rizzuto with the Yankees,
right.
He batted just ahead of Stan Musial, if I remember correctly.
Probably.
And I heard him say, he said, yes, sir, sometimes he could have stretched that into a double.
Yeah.
But he said he had to think about, he had to hold. Because of what it meant, who were coming up on the bat, and what that meant to the team, and not what it meant to one more double for Ren Shandies, but it was a single.
Very good point. He wanted to keep the hole open at first base.
That's right,
Very good point.
And I don't see that kind of attitude. I think the game has changed that way because everybody's saying, hey, here comes salary negotiations. I'm the first or second ball player to have 30 home runs, 30 doubles, or 30 stolen bases, and it takes away from the art of the game and really what it means.
I think that's probably true. I've noticed in the playoffs and in the World Series, they do more of those things they're supposed to do than they do during the regular season, and it even goes into umpiring. I even back in my day... I've noticed some of the umpires that I didn't think were very good umpires. Mm-hmm. In the World Series, they were good umpires because they were bearing down and never pitch, never play. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a terrible thing to say, but I think that may be true.
Probably true with all of us whenever, whatever.
I think so, yeah. That's just human nature.
Yeah. I'm faced with a pressure situation.
Yeah.
I'm gonna...
Well, I've been very fortunate. I've never been fired. Maybe if I'd stayed around a little longer, I would have been. But I worked for... great baseball people. When I was in Detroit for 5 years, I had Jim Campbell, and of course in New York I had Topping and Webb, and then Lee McPhail came in there, and Roy Hamey, and they were all great. Mm-hmm. And then Boston, I had Sullivan and Mrs. Yawkey, and so I've had a very fortunate career in baseball.
For some people that say, if I just had that experience once, I could count it up, but you've had it multiplied several times.
Well, it's been unlucky. I've had great players to manage, and people like when I went into Detroit, why Al was there, Kaline, and Bill Freehan, and people like that, and they backed me 100%, and that made it easy for me. Mm-hmm. And then Jim, we had an 18-game losing streak in Detroit. And I'll never forget. And of course, when I went there, they told me we're going to have to change the ball club.
Mm-hmm.
That everybody had gotten too old. And that was a tough job for a year or two. Because the people don't understand when you let a Northrop or a Stanley or a Freehand go and things like that. Or Willie Horton. But we went, they said we got to go with youth, which we did. And then the club was doing real well when I decided to retire. And then a year, I guess, later, the Boston talked me into coming back, and I stayed there for 4 years. But I've been lucky. I left clubs when everybody was happy and things going good, which is a nice way to
leave. That's characteristic of a Kansan.
That was nice to leave that way,
That was. You saw, of course, you managed the Yankees in 1960-61. I must share a story with you when the Yankees were playing Pittsburgh in Forbes Field and Mazeroski came up to bat. I was driving my 54 Ford on highway coming in from Eudora to Lawrence, Kansas. You know, perhaps you know that highway.
I sure do.
And I was driving, big smile on my face, boy, another World Series, and I was giving a speech in Lawrence, Kansas, and Mazeroski up to bat, and I said, Ralph Terry will take care of this character. And just happy. The time I got to Lawrence, I had a long winter.
That was unbelievable, wasn't it?
You were there. You were the.
Yeah, I was the first base coach, and that was Casey's last year. And fact is, I saw Mazeroski just last week.
Did you retrace that story?
Oh, it's been retraced millions of times, and again last week. And we were in a golf tournament at Kiowa Island for National
Park. Are you sharing that conversation or for the Hall of Fame?
Sure, I don't mind that.
Okay.
And that was the series before that last game where Casey had, and I was sitting on the bench, and Casey had told me that he thought he was going to retire probably, or might retire at the end of the year, and he said, I hope you're going to be the manager. And at that time, I was thinking of going to Kansas City because they had approached me to manage there. And that's how that all started. And then, of course, later, Casey said, well, he was forced to leave, which kind of upset me. But
yes. At
that time, I thought that he was going to announce, you know, retirement. But, yeah, Maz, he's something else. Yeah.
Did he believe it himself, or did he see that ball big as a pineapple
I really don't know. I don't know. I know that it was a shock to me.
Yes.
Because I thought we were, you know, we had come from behind so often, and it was so many runs. And we outscored him. It was an immense amount of runs. And
incredible.
It was almost as sickening as...
almost a 4-1 run.
Well, like the time, you know, we lost 4 straight to the Dodgers in 63.
Yes.
And the only... Of course, they'll argue with you, but I think we had a much better ball club than they had, but we just couldn't hit Drysdale and Koufax.
Mm-hmm.
And in a short series, pitching usually wins. And
like this last World Series.
Yeah, pitching usually wins in a World Series.
Yeah. The A's heart of the lineup went flat. They couldn't get on base.
They couldn't get on base, and once they got into Myers and Dibbio, that was it.
Uh-huh.
And that's what wins. It's just like you don't see really any team, even back in the 60s, when relief pitching became so important, I don't think you can hardly win a pennant unless you have that one real good man that can give you that one inning or two innings at the end of the game if you're ahead and keep you from losing games that you've got the one-run lead.
Mm-hmm.
And, for instance, that was the biggest thing Minnesota did when they got Reardon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, without Reardon, they don't win.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Oakland with Eckersley, that's been a great thing for them. And all teams have to have that.
Yeah.
If you got two of them, then you really got it going.
Mm-hmm. The future of baseball, do you see major leagues developing in Taiwan, in Japan, in the Caribbean, if the Cuba political situation ever changes? They have some fantastic ball players. The Dominican Republic, Central America. Do you see that, you know, maybe early in the next century that we will have maybe American League and National League in the United States and Canada, but we'll have some other kind of major leagues elsewhere?
I don't see why that couldn't happen. I mean, I think that can happen. Your transportation today is getting faster and faster and faster. And I see no reason why that couldn't happen. We'll just think in the old Coast League, when they had teams in Hawaii before they had the fast transportation, you can get to these other places now quicker than they could get to Hawaii in those days with the planes they had.
Yeah.
And there's no question, but we know Cuba's got great ball players, and they certainly have great ball players in Puerto Rico. And the Latin countries have great teams, and you see what happens in the little leagues. They're coming over here and winning. Yeah, I think that can happen. Mm-hmm. Sure do.
Mm-hmm. I've speculated in my own mind. I've never.
How do you feel about it?
I really firmly believe that, especially in the Caribbean, will I think be. I think they could really be there in San Juan in the Dominican Republic. I think it will happen in Cuba after Fidel Castro leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Politically, I don't think it could go now. I see it in some ways in Japan and Taiwan and the Philippines, except those players are so much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
that the muscle power, you know, the strength combined with speed would, I think, be still at a...
I don't know about that. Rizzuto wasn't very big.
Yes, that's right. They call him Scooter for nothing.
And I'm surprised he's not in the Hall of Fame. Bobby Shantz, there's been some great small guys.
That's right.
That's the one good thing about baseball. I agree with you. The big, strong people maybe have a little bit of an edge, mm-hmm. and maybe they don't. I don't know. But in most sports, well, especially basketball and football, mm-hmm. you almost have to be big, as we all know. Where in baseball, you really don't. The littlest guy has a chance to be a major leaguer, and I think that's a big plus.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people talk to me, they figure I'm going to say, well, baseball today isn't as good as it was years mm-hmm. ago. And I disagree with that. I mm-hmm. think baseball today is better than it was mm-hmm. years ago. And mainly the reason, I think players honestly take better care of themselves, most of them, in the mm-hmm. off-season and come to spring training in better shape. And today, we have coaches that, like right now, the minor leaguers are training right here in Winter Haven. Mm-hmm. And actually, we're part of Winter Haven here where we live. And I can go down there, and they're down there, and they've got their best prospects. And mm-hmm. they got a pitching coach, they got an infield coach, they got a catching coach. And they're there working with these kids. Well, that didn't happen.
Major League teams didn't have that the 40s and 50s.
No, they didn't have that. And you take especially a young pitcher. They'll down there, and they're watching his ability, his speed, and all that. And they'll say, this guy's got a chance to be a relief pitcher, maybe better than a starter. And they train these young guys to be a relief pitcher, which years ago they took the old pitcher that wasn't winning anymore and made a relief pitcher out of it. But they're doing all those things now, and they're working with the catchers, with the mm-hmm. catcher. And when I came up, they didn't do that. They just went out and played.
Sure. You better learn by trial and error.
That's right, and uh-huh. and they don't do that anymore. So they got to be better.
Mm-hmm.
They got better
gloves, feels.
Better. It's mm-hmm. it's. I think it's like any other sport. It's gotten better.
I tend to agree with you. If nothing else, I think the uniforms are better because I, as a kid, in the old 3-2 league in Kansas City, Mr. Halleck, we had those old baggy woolly, and itch. When you sweat,
they were heavy.
They were heavy.
They were heavy. You're right.
And though I'm not sure who will listen to this tape, I'm sorry, the story doesn't come to me. And now I know that the pants are much tighter fitting today.
Absolutely.
I heard story that that you can always tell the first base runner if he's going to go by watching how tense his buttocks muscles are.
Could be.
That's why they've been saying they can't read the third base coach's sign yeah. about a steal.
Yeah.
They watch how tense his rear end is.
How about that?
And that's why they've been trying to catch a lot of them.
How about that?
Now, the baggy uniforms, you didn't have to worry about the muscles showing through.
Well, you know, a lot of, they claim Crosetti, for instance. And maybe he did. I don't know. You know, if you wanted to get on base, you'd take that baggy uniform, a shirt, and kind of pull it out, and then just let that ball nick you. You know,
we
used to do that. Uh-huh. And catchers used to try to get signs, like a wiggle man at one pitch or mm-hmm. something, and they'd watch if he was a muscular guy,
mm-hmm.
and it was hot weather, they'd try to watch for the muscles in the arm uh-huh. and things like that. So that could be true.
Yeah.
They didn't have to worry about that when I was on base.
No, they. They kind of
they said, just don't worry.
We'll concentrate on the batter.
No, just don't worry about it. Get the hitter.
I must come back to the Yankees only because I'm prejudiced.
Well, that's where I spend most of my career.
If I mentioned some players, some thoughts that would come to your mind, Roger Maris is one that, of course, you worked with him. You know, you brought him in from Kansas City in that trade.
Well, Roger, of course, the big year naturally was 61 mm-hmm. when he hit all the home runs and broke the record. And he should be in the Hall of Fame. Roger was a great ball player and a great family man. He could do a lot of things besides hit home runs.
Mm-hmm.
He was an excellent base runner, and he would break up double plays. He would give himself up to win a ball game.
So he would come in there sliding hard.
He did. He would break up that double play. He would go from first to third. He had a great arm.
Mm-hmm.
And probably against San Francisco saved the series with the throw he made from right field. And he went through a tough year in 61, although he had the great year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he
it was almost bittersweet.
Yeah, he was a Midwest guy, and the publicity, he was a team player, and the writers that toward the end of that year just, we could win a ball game, which he had nothing to do with.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of interviewing the guy that maybe won the ball game, they'd be running to him and asking, why didn't you hit this guy and this and that and all that kind of stuff. And that hurt Roger. And I truthfully think at one time, he didn't even want to break the record. And I know in Baltimore, you probably read where he didn't want to play the night he hit his 60th.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally talked him into playing. He was losing his hair, and he just was in bad shape. And I said, Rod, why don't you just... I said, all these people are here, and it's going to be awful if you're not in the lineup. I said, why don't you just go out there for one inning, and then when you come in, I'll get you out of it. And he finally consented to that, and then he stayed in. He didn't come to me, and that night he hit his 60th, as I remember right. But he was a great individual, and but I think that's when he left New York. He had decided to retire, and then later... He of course, he lived in Kansas City at that time. He agreed to go to St. Louis, but that's the only team he would go to. And, and Mr. Bush offered him a real good deal there. Mm-hmm. So we got what we could get at that time.
Enos Slaughter.
Well, he's just all baseball, and he's a runner and a fast runner. And I saw Enos last week, too.
Oh, he did?
Looks great. And he's just a guy to bear down all the time. He was from the old school. I mean, real old school.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody called him Mr. Hustle. And he was a good hitter. And that's where Mr. Weiss was pretty smart in the Yankees. They would maneuver to get, of course, we had a lot of farm clubs, so they could afford to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just a bear down type ball player. That's no question about it. And a good one.
Mm-hmm. Whether it was an infield pop up or a dribble.
He ran every
base
ball out there. He ran every ball out, and he was worked as hard as any man I've ever seen in spring training. He was like a Yastrzemski and Kaline, those people. They worked hard in spring training. He was a worker.
I'm reminded of Carlton Fisk. You know, in some ways, I think of him from the old school. You know, he keeps that physical condition.
Yeah.
And then when, what's that fellow, Saunders, was with the Yankees for a while.
Yeah, Sanders.
Sanders.
Yeah,
and
went to Atlanta football.
I almost wrote a letter to Carlton Fisk when I read about in the paper when Saunders didn't run out that play.
Yeah.
Foul ball
I
or I don't remember what.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, good for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, because when somebody doesn't do that, it doesn't only affect that.
That's
his
right.
teammates, it affects
That's
that
right.
other team as well.
That's right.
And... So I deliberately asked you about Country Boy Slaughter because of that hustle.
He ran every ball out. I don't care where it was.
It went. Hank Bauer.
Well, Hank was my best man at my wedding, believe it or not. And
I didn't know that, but I'm glad I mentioned Hank Bauer.
Yeah, and we were still good friends. Fact is, I'll see him at the Whitey Ford Mantle Fantasy Camp next week, I think.
Where's that going to be?
It's in Fort Lauderdale.
Uh-huh.
And... he goes 2 weeks. I go the 4th over there through the 11th.
Mm-hmm.
But Hank and I are close, very close friends, and he's another Mr. Hustle.
Mm-hmm.
And he, without a doubt, got the most out of his ability. And he was a bear-down player all the time and a tough, tough guy. And they just don't come any better than mm-hmm. Hank. Hank's just a super individual in my book.
My wife on that fantasy camp, my wife a year ago, we have two boys in college at Florida State University,
It
has to wait till we pay that bill.
Yeah.
But she said, now, Dan, you save up half the money. My wife's a physical therapist. I'll save up the other half so you can go to fantasy camp. So I hope in a few years to see you there, okay?
That'd be great.
And I want you to appraise my back. I'm 54 years old, and I really want you to give me a true picture of my... being a free agent.
We have a lot of fun at those camps,
uh-huh.
and they are expensive. It always amazes me the people that come to them, what they pay to go, of course. But they're getting their fantasy. They get, as you know, they get the real uniform, and we try to make it like a spring training, you know, to a certain point.
Uh-huh.
And yet, it kind of some of the fellas, they play so hard, and they're not in the shape they should be. And we've had some minor injuries, but normally we've never had a real serious one. We had one pretty close at a Minnesota camp, but we've never really had a real. Mm-hmm. But we have doctors, people that operate, and you know, things like that. They're out there, their fingers.
Oh dear. George Weiss, the general manager, who must have had a combination of a shrewd business mind as well as an astute judge of baseball players.
Well, I think he's like anybody else. He was a sharp man, and he had great baseball people working for him, and he respected their judgment. And I think that's probably the key to a lot of successful people in baseball. I think.
So he didn't second guess the professionals you.
I don't think he did. I think he was a kind of an aloof man, and he was a fellow that he managed to keep good people working for him, and then he evaluated through them. In fact, is the whole that's the way the Yankee organization more or less operated. We had our meetings, everybody listened, and I don't think, you know, they didn't make trades without everybody discussing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's sort of the way I was brought up. Mm-hmm. Like if we were going to try to make a deal, like Lee McPhail or Jim Campbell or Sullivan or Boston, we would discuss the deal, we'd call scouts, and we wouldn't, and then if we wanted to do it, then we'd call. Yeah, I get to talking too. That's all right.
Eddie Lopez.
Well, Eddie is a fellow that was very involved in pitching, and I would say he's one of the pitchers that got about as much out of his ability as any pitcher you've ever seen, because he knew how to.
He pee. Didn't have a fast pitch.
No, he was a little sneaky. He was sneaky fast. He reminded me of a left-handed Boddicker with Boston now. But he had a good change. He knew how to pitch. He was a student of pitching. And he had that outstanding control. He could get the ball over on any count.
Mm-hmm. And play the corners.
You'd be going along, and then all of a sudden he'd zip a fastball that would look a lot faster than it was, and that's the way he pitched. But he loved the game, and he was in it for a long time. I guess he still is. I'm not sure.
He lives in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Tom Ferrick told me that he had a cancer operation here a few months ago, and he's recuperating.
I didn't realize that.
So, this tape I made of Tom Ferrick and Tommy Hendrick and many of the others, I sent a copy to him because Tom said he would enjoy listening to their stories.
Yeah.
I didn't hear from him, but anyway, I went ahead. One of the most underrated pitchers of the Yankees and had a terrific win-loss percentage, Spud Chandler. And I heard that he was one of the fiercest competitors, and that no one really went out on the pitcher's mound. That was his territory.
That's right.
He kind of stayed away.
Well, Spud, I'll never forget Spud. He had a great curveball, and as you say, was one of the most fierce competitors and would pitch hurt or anything like that. In the few games that I got to catch in the major leagues, it so happened that one of them was in Detroit, and I was catching Spud, and Newhouser was pitching.
Oh, Hal Newhouser.
Yeah, against us. And you didn't talk to Spud before a ball game. I mean, the day he pitched, you don't talk to Spud. He's in a world of his own, boy. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty lucky that day, we'd had a meeting, and had gone over the hitters with Bucky. And Lake was playing shortstop for the Tigers then. He was a little bitty guy. And he was the kind of guy who liked to get walks, but he was a first ball hitter.
Mm-hmm.
And Bucky said, it might not be a bad idea, he said, you know, to throw a curveball on the first pitch to him. We had gone over the hitters. Now the game starts, and I call for a curveball.
Mm-hmm.
It's Spud shook me off. I called Curve again. So I called for the fastball. And you'd never believe this. He hit the ball out of the ballpark. And we were behind 1-0. So now the game goes on. I seen Bucky, but Bucky didn't say nothing because he knew. So anyway, the game goes on, and would you believe I got a base hit to put us ahead, 2-1. And now Spud's pitching great. We get into the eighth inning, and we got him beat, I think, 3-1 by now. And I made the mistake of saying, God damn, I said, that curveball's really breaking good. Hey, don't talk to me. This is during the ball game, you know? And he said something like, just you do the catching or something like that. And I couldn't believe it. And I never said another word. And we won the ball game.
Yeah.
That's the kind of guy was. He was a bear down. And when he didn't pitch, one of the nicest guys you've ever seen. You know, I mean, but the day he pitched, boy, he didn't mess with
you.
Just
stayed a few feet away.
You bet.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think the designated hitter thing will be abolished in the very near future in the American League?
I don't think so. I think the National League will have it.
You think so?
I definitely think so. I disagree with all the people. You don't hear. To me, it was much harder to manage with the designated hitter than it was without it. I think it'll definitely be in the National League. To start with, it keeps the ball game moving all the time.
Mm-hmm.
With a pitcher hitting, you're really hitting with six innings.
Mm-hmm.
You know what when they're going to bunt. And it takes three offensive innings out of a ball game. That pitcher can be replaced by a guy can run real good, a guy that's a great defensive player, or he can be replaced with a Mickey Mantle or a Willie Stargell or somebody like that. Or it'll keep a star in the game longer, for one thing, which the people want to see. And I know managing, you had to know when to take that pitcher out with the designated hitter. Well, the other way, it was automatic.
That's right. You had to think a couple of innings
ahead.
Well,
sure. If you're behind in the eighth inning, you're going to use a pinch hitter. The other thing, it explodes ball games without the designated hitter. Like, let's say your starter has a bad first three innings, and he's a good pitcher. But now you get into the fifth inning, you almost have to make a move if the situation's right. Now, if you don't score that inning, what do? If they got a good pitcher pitching against you, you bring in the worst pitcher you have because you've blown that. You're not going to waste. All of a sudden, you got a ball game that nobody's watching anymore. Yeah. They're all leaving the stadium. Mm-hmm. So I think the designated hitter definitely is.
He's going to stay.
Oh, yeah. Of course, you're going to get managers in the National League say this is terrible, because that's their bread and butter, you know. So, but I manage with both systems, and I think it's tougher to manage with the designated hitter, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah. I see you have many more options.
And you have to do this.
Yeah. I mean, and where that's going to be.
And the other thing,
like now,
if you've got a good pitcher, and all of a sudden he is behind, but he's a good pitcher. He just had bad luck. He scored three runs or even four runs. He can stay in there. So you're keeping the ball game closer. And that's what the fans want, close ball game.
That's right. Mr. Houck, I know you have another obligation. Are there any kind of notes and summaries, as we have talked, some thoughts or experiences that have come up that kind of conclude our conversation here this morning?
Well, I was just thinking, after we've talked about all these players and, you know, the difference in the money and all that kind of stuff today and years before, I just feel like I've been lucky to have worked with great organizations like the Yankees, Detroit, and Boston, and Minnesota. And, of course, we have a very nice home here. We're on the golf course, and doing things that I never thought as a kid I'd be able to do. And so I'm just feel lucky that baseball's been so good to me and that I was in the right place at the same time, at the right time. And I have no regrets. You hear people moan about the players making, hey, I've been lucky. So I feel real good about it. I've enjoyed the years managing people like Earl Weaver and working for Lee McPhail and our meetings and the Winter League meetings. So baseball's been great to me and my family. I owe it everything. And And I'm a very fortunate man.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Houck.
My pleasure, Dad.